Hello and welcome to The Principles. My guest today is multiple book author Mark Gober. I'm going to read you a little bit about his bio and then we'll get straight to the episode. Mark Gober is author of An End to Upside Down Thinking, which he wrote in 2018, which won the IPP Award for the Best Science Book of the Year. And it's that book that we're going to be discussing today. He's also author of An End to Upside Down Living, 2020, An End to Upside Down Liberty, 2021, An End to Upside Down Contact, 2022, and An End to Upside Down Reset, 2023, and An End to Upside Down Medicine, 2023. And he's also host of the podcast, Where Is My Mind, 2019. Additionally, he serves on the board of Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell's Institute of Noetic Sciences. Previously, Gober was a partner at Sherpa Technology Group in Silicon Valley and worked as an investment banking analyst with UBS in New York. He's been named one of IAM's Strategy 300, the world's leading intellectual property strategists. Gober graduated magna cum laude from Princeton University, where he wrote an award-winning thesis on Daniel Kahneman's Nobel Prize-winning prospect theory and was elected a captain of Princeton's Division I tennis team. Now, quickly on this book, and you'll see here the other books. In An End to Upside Down Thinking, Mark Gober traces his journey. He explores compelling scientific evidence from a diverse set of disciplines, ranging from psychic phenomena to near-death experiences to quantum physics and beyond. With cutting-edge thinkers like two-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee Dr. Evrin Laszlo, Pixar founder and two-time Academy Award winner Lauren Carpenter, chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences Dr. Dean Radin, University of Virginia's professor Dr. Ed Kelly, and New York Times bestselling author Larry Dossey, MD, supporting this thesis, this book will rock the scientific community and mainstream generalists interested in understanding the true nature of reality. And I'm having this conversation with him because it builds on the conversation I had with Dawn Lester recently about the nature of reality. I hope you enjoy this as much as I did. I'll put links to Mark's work in the show notes. And if you're interested in this, I wish you a really enjoyable journey as you dive into this and look at the compelling evidence that is presented. Take care of yourself, and I'll see you in the next video. Goodbye. I find it hard to believe we only met briefly just last week after an introduction by Dawn. But, you know, really thank you for suddenly jumping on the show with me because I think this is going to be a good episode.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I know we already have a lot in common and we're both very curious people, so I'm excited for this.
Yeah. Some of your background, because for me, you were the kind of archetypal business guy that you were in that world.
I think from the outside, I was an archetypal business guy on a standard track. In hindsight, I realized I was always a little bit different, even though I was able to mold myself to the system because I was so focused on succeeding from a young age. I mean, I was a competitive tennis player starting at 8 years old, playing in tournaments. And very quickly, I became interested in grades and succeeding. And that continued for me into college. I went to Princeton. So that was a high pressure environment, both the tennis, which is Division I. Wow. Which is at that level is sort of like a job on top of school voluntarily, but it was high intensity and a lot of pressure, but also there a lot of good things too. And then academically, very challenging. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have a sense at that point of where I was going beyond just wanting to continue to succeed. So I went into investment banking, which is where a lot of my classmates went as well. But for me, it was in 2008. This was during the financial crisis.
That's a good time to do it.
It was really tough. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to put into words what that experience was like. Investment banking, especially in New York, is challenging enough. It's as an analyst, which is the entry-level position, you're basically expected to work around the clock. That's just part of the job. But then you throw on top of it the financial crisis. And I was at a bank called UBS, which is one of the largest global investment banks that was in the news for having problems like all the other banks. And then the group that I was placed in was called the Financial Institutions Group, meaning that we did advisory for other financial institutions. So the other banks and insurance companies and asset managers that were basically going under, they were all looking for help to raise money or to restructure or to merge or to sell. So that meant we were either pitching these companies to be their advisor or actually being on the deals. And so it was extremely tough. It was not good for my health or my sanity, but I did it until 2010. And then I left to join a little bit of a different kind of a firm based in Boston, but primarily in Silicon Valley is where I spent most of my time. And we were advising technology-focused companies on their innovations, their intellectual property, their patents. So somewhat similar to what I did in New York, but a little more on the innovative side. But again, still just down this traditional track of being a business person. And as I progressed in my career, I became more and more nihilistic in my worldview, where I thought life didn't have meaning. And I thought that's what science taught us, basically, that if you believe something spiritual or religious, you were in some kind of an archaic way of thinking, because science had transcended that. That's what I believe. So I just thought, well, I'm on this treadmill, and eventually there's going to be the end of life and that lights go out. So what does any of this matter? And if I succeed in something, why does that matter? And if I fail in something, why does that matter? It's hard to continue in that way for too long. So I hit a wall starting, I could probably trace it before this, but maybe 2014, 15, and really 2016, where I felt like I was a zombie. Why am I going through all this? Not in a great state of mind. And then, long story short, things changed because I started listening to podcasts that exposed me to new information about the nature of reality, which has turned into my biggest passion, where eventually I left my firm. And now
let me stop you right there. Sorry for interrupting you, but did you specifically go looking, or did it just something that kind of come across a feed one day and you listened to it and thought, what?
That's a very good question. So I started listening to podcasts, I believe it was early 2016, when a friend of mine forwarded me a Tim Ferriss episode with Mark Andreessen, a venture capitalist. So at the time, podcasts weren't as widespread. And I remember listening to it saying, wow, this is incredible. You can listen to a very smart person, an expert in his field, for hours. And there's lots of these out there. So then I started listening to more episodes. And Tim Ferriss was focused on alternative health in addition to just like business. So kind of all over the place. And then I started listening to alternative health shows because I was also thinking about my own state of mind. What can I be doing? And people were talking about sensory deprivation, flotation tanks, where you float in salt water in a pod. So I started to do that. And just, I was exploring with things. And it happened to be that one day on a show called Extreme Health Radio, I didn't seek out the episode because of any like special desire. There was a woman whose name is Laura Powers, who talked about her psychic abilities that she had harnessed and shut them out as a child. And now she's communicating with interdimensional beings and speaking very seriously about this. And then at the end of the episode, after I thought she sounded like a serious person, I mean, I couldn't figure out what was going on. Is she delusional? Is she lying? I'm not sure. But she said she had her own podcast called Healing Powers. And I was listening to lots of podcasts. So I said, why don't I try this one? And I had a long drive every day from San Francisco to Silicon Valley with traffic. So I listened to her episodes, and there was person after person describing what to me sounded like insane spiritual experiences, but they were very similar, even though the people had different backgrounds and they weren't connected to each other. So I couldn't reconcile that, because any one of the episodes, what maybe I could try to just say that there's something here that we can dismiss it. But when you put all of these pieces together, they had a very similar worldview that I would now call a spiritual one, one that suggests that our human body is just a vehicle or a vessel for our essence or soul or consciousness, and that there's life after death, and you can communicate with beings that we don't see with our eyes, and that basically life is not what we're told. That was the general view. So then I started to read books and peer-reviewed scientific papers that was pointing to this too. So I was like totally disoriented in early and this was like the end of 2016, because most of my friends and people in my network were not thinking this way. And I was having this shift because I couldn't dismiss every single piece of evidence that was coming my way. And the evidence base was building to the point where even if I wanted to try to shoot them all down, I couldn't logically do it. So I didn't know how I was going to function in the world. I was still working at my firm. And I was coming from this place where I thought life was meaningless, but now wait, maybe you're having a rebirth because life is totally different. And that's the beginning of this journey that's led me to write multiple books and eventually leave my job. I became a partner at the firm and left the job right before everything happened with COVID. So here I am now writing beyond consciousness, also into political issues, into socioeconomic issues, medicine. My questioning of reality has expanded everywhere, but all of the questions relate to fundamental issues of our existence and why we're here.
Okay, so your first book then, it was called An End to Upside Down Thinking, wasn't it?
That's right.
You talk, I haven't read the book yet, but I'm going to read it because it looks really interesting. But you're obviously going to talk a lot about consciousness. So one of the questions that you and I talked about was, what is consciousness and why does consciousness and why does it matter? What would you say to that?
Consciousness is a very difficult term to define because it is not a physical thing that we can point to and characterize in a physical way. But the way I like to think about it is that it is the part of us that is having an experience. So some would call it our subjective inner awareness. There are lots of ways to try to describe it, but it's distinct from the perceptions that we have. To me, the perceptions and even the thoughts that occur in the mind are experiences within consciousness. So if I say that I have a thought, that sentence already distinguishes between I and the thought. So the sense of I-ness is what I mean by consciousness on an individual level. But I also now, from my metaphysical perspective, view that sense of I-ness to be interconnected with the other I-nesses that are out there, that there's an interconnectedness between all consciousness.
A bit like it's a large ocean, but there's individual pieces or drops in the ocean that we're all there, but we're all part of the same thing as well.
Yes. Another analogy that I've often used is from Dr. Bernardo Kastrup, that we're whirlpools within a stream. So individuated areas of water within something interconnected.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Welcome to the Alchemy of Natural Healing. I'm your host, Laurel Dewey. True healing is an alchemical process, meaning it must transform you on all levels, body, mind, and spirit. What affects one affects all three. True healing is one of the hardest journeys you'll ever travel, but it's one of the most rewarding and fulfilling when you get to meet yourself for the first time. If you're ready to take that journey, let's get started.
That's really cool. That's really cool. So your book then that you wrote, that sounds like it's a research book more than anything.
Yeah. And really all the books have been, and it's probably because I come from a background of having to present to clients and boards of directors and senior management to have my points laid out and all the sources backed up.
Yes.
So I'm coming from that perspective, also hoping to appeal to people who have that kind of logical mind. But the first book, especially, because I was still working in Silicon Valley at the time. And at first I'm like, can I really write a book about, I mean, it gets into the scientific evidence of consciousness and the way we talked about it. So that means consciousness surviving when the body dies, reincarnation, psychic phenomena, mind impacting matter without physical contact. These are insane ideas for the world that I was in. So I had to really back it up. And that, I've used that approach for all the areas, but especially that first one. I mean, it's a research book compiling what many other people have done in a new way.
Yeah. Okay. And in that, you conclude that consciousness, and I believe this as well, isn't created in the brain. Why did you come to that conclusion?
Well, it's interesting because I didn't start with the idea of consciousness and the brain. I started on this journey learning about what I would call anomalies. These are things that don't fit within the current paradigm of consciousness. And when I realized I was seeing various things, whether it's psychic phenomena, near-death experiences, mediumship, they all related to the same idea, which is that our consciousness is not tied to the brain exclusively. The brain seems to be involved in how we experience things. But most people, including myself, I would have said to you before, well, the reason that we have any experience at all is because of chemical and electrical activity in our skull, and that's it. And when you shut the brain off, therefore, that's the end of your experience and your consciousness. But correlation does not necessarily imply causation. So there are other ways to think about, why would it be that the brain lights up when you have certain conscious experience? Well, maybe the brain is a transducer or a receiver transmitter of consciousness, or a filtering mechanism where, you know, it's sort of like if you have a television set and you're watching a show, you realize that there's an antenna picking up a signal. So you take a hammer and smash the antenna, and the TV show that you're watching, all of a sudden it's scratchy, it's not clear. It's not because the signal has been damaged, but rather the apparatus that was processing the signal, that's been damaged. So that's how I think about the brain now.
Okay, that's really interesting. And that would tie in with another question then, because you mentioned near-death experiences, and I've been looking into that a lot recently in the last couple of months, and I find that absolutely fascinating. Could you talk a little bit more about that, please?
To me, it's one of the most important areas to look at for any human being, because people describe, and have been throughout history, by the way, in cultures all over the world. There's a researcher named Dr. Gregory Shushan, who has looked at cross-cultural near-death experiences very closely, including in indigenous cultures, looking at similarities and differences. But this is a phenomenon that's been reported for many, many years. But the difference between now and more historical cases is that our medical resuscitation technology has improved dramatically in the last few decades. So now we're bringing more people back, whereas perhaps they would have died previously. And many of them are describing these elaborate things where their consciousness, in spite of having an extreme medical condition, so let's say cardiac arrest, where blood stops flowing to the brain, oftentimes clinical death, sometimes it's not that extreme, but these are instances where a person's in a majorly traumatized state in, from a physiological sense, they could die. And yet their consciousness, in spite of their damaged body and or brain, their consciousness is having an expanded experience. So for my podcast, I interviewed Dr. Bruce Grayson from the University of Virginia.
I listened to that one. It was fascinating.
Okay. So he told me, we have a paradox that at a time when the brain isn't functioning, the mind is functioning better than ever. That alone, okay, wait a second. So the brain is shut off and people have 360 degree vision, or they say it's realer than real. Their senses are expanded. There's a book called Mindsight by Dr. Kenneth Ring, and I think he has a co-author, where they look at people who have been blind since birth and they have a near-death experience and they can see, and then they go back into their body, they're blind again. So there's something about this state where there is an expansion of reality and an enriched consciousness. Now, some people might listen to that and say, well, we can explain that because there are changes in brain chemistry. There are new endorphins or perhaps DMT produced in the brain. There's an oxygen deprivation. Lots of theories posed that try to preserve a physiological explanation. But there are cases where in this near-death state, people describe their consciousness hovering over their body. Sometimes they're immersed in unconditional love and they encounter deceased relatives or beings of light, so actual intelligences. But they're hovering over their body, sometimes even outside the room that they're in. And they come back and when they're resuscitated and they tell people what happened to them and they're accurate. These are known as veridical out-of-body experiences, verified memories. And what's important about this is that the memories can be time-stamped because they know what the body physiology was doing based on the memory that was told. And we know that the body shouldn't have been capable of producing a memory that was accurate, let alone one from a vantage point, a perspective not in the body. These are some of the most convincing cases to me and other researchers that at least some near-death experiences are not hallucinations. And therefore, to your earlier point, they might tell us something about the nature of reality beyond what our body and our brain typically show us. And that's the significance to me.
One of the things you said there was really interesting about, you know, they're blind, they can, when they come back, they're blind in their body, but they could see in the near-death experience. I've done quite a lot of digging and looking into what do they call it now? Dissociative identity disorder, which used to be multiple personality disorder as it was known then. And in different personalities, you can have people that are physically blind and they have sight in the other personality.
Mm.
Yeah, there's a lot of really interesting things going on. Anyway, thank you for that. That was really interesting. So could you talk a little bit about non-localized consciousness?
It's the idea that the consciousness is not stuck inside of the brain and the body. And with a near-death experience, that's one of the clearest cases because it's literally non-localized. Their consciousness is seeing or hearing things when we know the body is a certain place. And that concept, I mean, for me, I've researched this so much and I talk about it so much that I'm sort of numb. But if you're new to this topic, I mean, that is a big deal. What do you mean your consciousness can be non-local? I mean, there are other phenomena as well. Remote viewing. This is the ability to perceive things that are far away in space and or time with the mind alone, i.e. psychic spying. And the U.S. government, for example, has been using this for decades, and the documents are all declassified now. They say, these declassified documents, direct quote, remote viewing is a real phenomenon. Implications are revolutionary. I interviewed Russell Targ, who's one of the leaders of the program in the 1970s. And it's interesting when I talk to other people in the program too, that there's no doubt that these phenomena are real because it was being used practically. Former US President Jimmy Carter confirmed that it was used to find a downed Russian bomber that was lost in an African jungle and the radar systems couldn't find it. So they used these psychic spies, remote viewing, non-local consciousness. And there are other examples too. At Princeton University, there was a lab run by the former dean of engineering. It shut down in 2007, but it was going for about 30 years. And they were running these remote viewing experiments too, where they would send a person far away, and they would ask the remote viewer, where is this person? And then they would do it. They would do it independent of time too. So they would look in the past and the future where the person was, and people were able to successfully do it. So again, non-local, spatially and temporally. That means consciousness has this ability to be all over the place. And it for me initially was a reaction of, wait a second, there are these things about myself. Apparently these abilities are innate to all people, even though some might have stronger abilities or they harness them more. The abilities based on the science seem to be innate to all of us, and myself included. And I never knew that about myself. So it was a recontextualization of what a human being is.
You talked about non-localized consciousness, and you were talking about remote viewing, which I find fascinating. But the idea of back and forth in time, for me, it suggests that time is one level thing. It's not like the perception we have of time flowing from one end to the other. It's almost like all time exists at the same time.
Right. So the notion of sequential time could be regarded as an interpretation of our human perception. So we see things from past to present to future, but really in our mind always, because if we think about what the past is, it's a memory occurring in the present moment, and the future is a thought in the present moment. And even the definition of time is problematic because it's an interval between two events, and an interval is really a redefinition of time. So time becomes circular when we think about it. There's an analogy from Dr. David Hawkins, a spiritual teacher, who likened the perception of time to, if you imagine shooting light through a prism, you end up with this apparently three-dimensional looking hologram. Imagine that. And you could look at the hologram from one point and from another point, from another point. Those could be different points in time that we would interpret as sequence, but they're really part of just the same thing that's there, this ever-present now that's being interpreted or looked at and experienced from different angles.
That makes a lot of sense. You mentioned earlier about psychic events. Could you go a little deeper into that, please?
Well, one example was the remote viewing, but there are many other categories like telepathic communications and precognition, which is knowing or sensing the future before it happens, and psychokinesis, mind-matter interaction. And I'll give a few examples, but I want to preface this because when I first started on this research journey, I couldn't believe that there would be any science that suggested this was real, because that sounded like science fiction. And there are many researchers who have looked at this for decades, including Dr. Jessica Utz, who was the 2016 president of the American Statistical Association. So this is someone who's equipped to look at scientific evidence. And what she said, this is a direct quote, "Using the standards applied to any other area of science, it is concluded that psychic functioning has been well established." So very conclusive. And she said this actually in response to looking at the US government's remote viewing program, because there was a panel that wanted to explore, well, was there any use to this remote viewing? And that was her conclusion. But she was looking at other stuff too, because there's lots of other research. This was also summarized in 2018. In American Psychologist, which is the official peer-reviewed academic journal of the American Psychological Association, where Dr. Etzel Cardenia from Lund University in Sweden, he was compiling a meta-analysis of the sorts of psychic functioning that I mentioned before, like telepathy and otherwise, and they published the paper, which suggests that there is statistical evidence that was worthy of publication. So there are many ways of testing these things. I'll give one example of telepathy and then I'll pause. You separate two people. They're in two different rooms. So we'll call them Bob and Jane. Bob is put into a very relaxed state, just kind of hanging out. Jane is in another room far away. And the experimenters show Jane an image and they ask Jane to try to use her mind to send what she's seeing to Bob in the other room. She does that for a little while. And then Bob is shown four images and they say, "Bob, which of the four was Jane sending to you with her mind?" Now, the person in Bob's room, we would expect, if there were no effect at all psychically, would guess correctly around 25% of the time. It would approach one out of four because it should just be totally random, because there shouldn't be any way to transmit information from Jane. And in fact, what happens is that the person in Bob's room guesses correctly closer to 32% of the time, plus or minus, which statistically speaking is a massive difference or deviation from chance. And this falls in the category, it's known as Six Sigma results, meaning the odds that this is due to chance alone is more than a billion to one, meaning something happened. And Dr. Dean Radin, who's the chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, wrote a book called Real Magic, which, by the way, was endorsed by two Nobel Prize winners. But he has a chapter called Scientific Evidence, and he describes the significance of Six Sigma and how it's been found in all these various categories. So I give this more scientific background because I was coming at it from this business lens. And here we have Six Sigma results, peer-reviewed papers, U.S. government. Something's going on.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely something's going on. So what do you think is going on with these psychic events?
To me, it is non-local consciousness of some kind. So if we go back to the whirlpool analogy, Dr. Kastrup's whirlpools within a stream of consciousness. And again, these are analogies, so it's not precise. But if you imagine some of the water from one whirlpool getting into another whirlpool, that's some of one person's consciousness getting into another. That would be like a psychic phenomenon, non-local. So we could imagine that we're part of this interconnected stream or ocean or something where under certain circumstances, the interconnectedness is felt. That's how I look at it.
Okay, that's interesting. I've read a lot about young children detailing events of past lives, and when they can specifically describe the place, the family, very, very detailed things that they have no way of knowing if they'd never been there before. Have you come across stuff like that?
Yes, and I actually interviewed Dr. Jim Tucker, who's a lead researcher at the University of Virginia. He's been looking at this. He continued the work of Dr. Ian Stevenson, who started this, I believe, in the late 1960s. So if your audience is not familiar with this, there's a division of perceptual studies at the University of Virginia. It's part of the medical school that is looking at reports of young children who remember alleged previous lives. That, to me, was mind-blowing that they were even looking in this area. And they've looked at over 2,500 cases, and some are stronger than other in terms of the evidence. But these are kids between the ages of 2 and 6 years old, so very young, describing specific details. Sometimes they have fears of things that don't really make sense based on this alleged previous life, or they have things that they're drawn to, like they might be drawn to tobacco or things that don't culturally make sense, but they are like these things. In the best cases, the researchers can find historical records or medical records that align with what the children are saying. Now, in some of the cases also, children have physical deformities or defects, so something in their body that you can see, and they'll say, well, yeah, I was tortured in a past life, or this is how I died, and these are the marks, or like birthmarks or various things. And in some of the cases, the researchers can find medical records that validate, yeah, there was a person that died in this way, and it corresponds with what the little child shows. And sometimes the deformities are really strange that don't, you know, and then the kid is able to tie it to specific murder or death. It's strange.
That is interesting, isn't it? So in your opinion, your observation, your thought, what do you think this place is, this realm is?
I really don't know. I don't know. It's one of my biggest questions. On so many levels, I don't know. Because my direct experience is telling me certain things based on what I can observe. But as we've just discussed, the implication is that there are many parts of our perceptual apparatuses that shut us down from a broader reality. And the implication of children with past life memories, by the way, the memories start to fade as they get older. And it implies, if we generalize those findings, that if past lives are real, it's not just a few kids here and there reporting them, then there's an amnesia that many of us have, meaning that we have a mind and a consciousness, but we're only accessing part of the stream all the time. And there are other parts that if we lit them up, we would realize we would have knowledge that we don't currently have. That's kind of strange. And then also, we have these abilities to perceive beyond what our eyes and ears typically show us. So what exists beyond what we can perceive? I mean, those questions alone blow open the lid on possibilities. And then you take the near-death experience, or people report maybe sometimes similar things in psychedelic or meditation experiences, transcendent states. They're talking about realms of existence that we don't see with our eyes.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good answer. I was having a discussion with some friends of mine the other night, And we were talking about one thing. And one of the things I was saying is, you know, that you don't see the entire electromagnetic spectrum with your eyes.
Right.
You don't hear the entire frequency range with your ears. And you know that from a dog, as an example, can hear far more than you can, or a dog can smell more than you can. You know, so that it seems to have any kind of experience. We have to block out so much stuff, because I think if we were able to perceive everything about everything, the experience would be very different than this one. It may not make any sense either, because you can't specifically focus in on something as well. Maybe that's what's going on. I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, we have a very limited range of perception, and we have to try to judge reality on that. And then a lot of our beliefs about our society, our history, things that are happening are based on other people's experiences that they relate to us. And as we've learned from so many different areas, that we can't always trust that, and we're being deceived, or sometimes people are innocently mistaken, or there are many, many possibilities where we could be told something and we infer something about the reality we're in and it's wrong.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So why do you think we're here in this realm? What do you think we're here to do?
My best guess right now, and it's actually been something like this since around the time I started researching, is that it's evolutionary. Not in a Darwinian sense per se. It's evolutionary in the sense that we, at the level of our consciousness, individually and collectively, are having experiences that lead to growth, that push us toward truth and love and interconnectedness. But we're doing that from a place where we're not in a pure state of that. So we're transcending new challenges that come up, and we're waking up in that process, and we're also navigating through discernment, deceptions, and darkness, and trying to overcome all of those things. And each of us seems to do that through different life experiences, but they have a similar evolutionary flavor. Okay, you just cut out. I heard half of what you said. We're seeing things from a vantage point and sharing with other people, but I missed everything after that.
You'll probably hear it now, but I bet the sound quality's gone down a bit.
Correct, I can hear you.
Cool. All right. So what I was saying was the idea that as we have our own focused view of reality through our own vantage point of our consciousness, well, we're experiencing it throughout this physical body, this lens, that everyone else is doing the same thing. It strikes me that consciousness is expanding through each of us having these things, besides what you just said as well.
Yes, I look at it that way too. The challenge I've had with the perspective is dealing with suffering and what we might call evil, especially the most extreme cases of just horrible abuses of human beings. How do we reconcile that with an evolutionary model? And the way I think about it is that it's sort of like going to the gym and working out. That can be painful, but in the end, it leads to a person who is in much better health and is fit and more resilient physically. So it's like there can be a benefit to pain and suffering in a sense. And at the same time, I don't think pain and suffering should be ignored, but one way of taking what I just said is, well, yeah, there's a lot of suffering in the world, so we should just ignore it. And they're all learning. There's nothing to do. I think Dr. David Hawkins, he would say that was a spiritual error to look at it that way, because when people are suffering, it's very real to them. And there's a duty of those who are not suffering to try to help other people in need. And at the same time, it could all be evolutionary.
Yes. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. So I've got to ask you this question. You came from not having written any books to writing a lot of books in a very short space of time. In particular, this first book, why did you put it together? And who's it aimed at?
When I first began researching, my intent was not to write a book. I was just curious about what I was learning. And that's been my process the whole time, even though now I can see the book further ahead because I just know how my research process goes. It always starts with my own curiosity and my desire to be able to express these paradigm shifts to people around me without seeming crazy, because it's pretty isolating. And it has been, because I've come from such a mainstream background of I learned something and I realized, wow, this is going to put me in a different place than everyone else I know. It's hard to look at the world the same way and even relate. How can I convey my paradigm shift to other people? And also, this paradigm shift and the other ones I've had are very positive for me in the end, because they're pointing closer to truth, I think. How can I share that with other people so they could have a similar shift without having to go through all the research I did and have to sift through all of it? If I could put it into one place for them and cite all the sources so they can research more if they want, that would kickstart their process. So for me, that idea to write started about a year after my initial research. So this was in the summer of 2017 while I was still working. And I just, when I wasn't working, basically, I would spend my time writing the book. And it came together very quickly. I turned on my investment banker mode and just wanted to write it as quickly as I could. And the book was then published the next year. So it's been that same process of curiosity and then summarizing it for other people.
Okay, that's really cool. I'm looking forward to reading it. So I'd like to know what you're up to now.
Well, my sixth book, An End to Upside Down Medicine, was published a few months ago. And since then, I speak about it a lot and have been on some, I just gave a lecture and at a conference in Texas a few weeks ago, for example. So I do promotion around the book and awareness, but I don't know what I'm going to do next. I've kind of been in this position many times since I left my firm, where I write a book and have all the inspiration to write, and then I publish it, and then I don't know what's next. And I continue researching. So I'm back to that position where I'm not really sure, but I have continued to have all these big questions that I feel like I've only partially answered in the books. So that's where I am now.
Okay. So what would you want the future to hold for you?
I enjoy the process of learning and having shifts that liberate my own mind and then sharing it with people. Because every paradigm shift that I feel like brings me closer to the truth and away from falsehoods or away from what I might call my past ignorance, not that I know the full truth now, but I feel like I'm closer. It's an expansive and evolutionary process for me. So I would love if I can structure my life such that I can continue to do this indefinitely. The problem is just writing books is, unless you're a big time author, it becomes a negative cash flow experience net. So fortunately I've been able to do this after having worked for so many years. But it's not sustainable in the long term. But I would love to find a way to be able to continue to research and then share it with people. I love doing that too.
Yeah. What message would you hope people get from this podcast?
There are two parts to it. One is my own journey. And the reason I talk about it is I know where I was, and I know there are a lot of people who are currently in a similar state, even if it's not identical to my journey. And the state being, there's a questioning of reality, questioning, why am I here? And then learning that there is another way that's actually backed by science that is a transformative path. And I'm certainly not the only one to have been on this path. So that's number one, is the personal aspect. And then number two is the concepts we're speaking about are mind expanding. And what I found in my own experience, and then other people who have been on this journey too, once they're exposed to some of this information, they find that synchronicities start happening in their life, where there are strange coincidences, or all of a sudden they are exposed to similar material that gives them evidence that these concepts are real. And those things are like, it's opening the door a tiny bit to what could be a major transformation down the road.
Yeah, brilliant. You're a good man. I've got huge respect for what you're doing, and I'm looking forward to speaking to you soon.
Thank you. Likewise, Adrian.
Look after yourself, man. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.